Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. June 6 marks the 75th anniversary of D-Day, a joint effort among U.S., British, and Canadian troops that is seen as the turning point of World War II. The Allied Forces Commander, U.S. General Dwight D. Eisenhower, told his troops that success that day would lead to the end of the Nazi grip on Europe.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world.
More than 9,000 Allied soldiers were killed or injured that day. Those who survived D-Day, the primary sources of its history, are dwindling. We're talking about how historians and others are working to keep the history alive and why it matters. Coming up, a veteran who parachuted behind enemy lines on D-Day will join us. Retired U.S. Army Colonel Peter Mansour is the General Raymond E. Mason, Jr. Chair of Military History at Ohio State. He joins us now. Welcome back, Peter Mansour.
Great to be here, Ann.
John Hawes is the manuscripts curator for the Ohio History Connection. His specialty is military history, and he's written extensively about Ohio's role in World War II. He joins us as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Nice to be here.
Do you feel like, John Hawes, like you're in a race against time right now?
Well, yes, because as you noted, many of the survivors are in their 90s now, and we're trying to get materials donated to us, especially at the Ohio History Connection where I work, to support and document the events that took place in World War II generally, but in D-Day specifically.
I read that for a long time, World War II veterans didn't talk about it, and they put things away. They didn't display their medals. They didn't display things that they got along the way. Yes. And does that kind of change your ability to gather things?
Yes, it does. But recently, I've seen many reports for veterans that in the last few years, they have started talking about it for many, many years, 40 years or more,
right,
or 50 years. They just didn't want to talk about it.
What do you think changed?
At some point, I guess they thought it needed to be told. They didn't want to talk about it in the earlier years. It was too painful. But now when they're in their 80s and 90s, they decided to talk about it. And many of their relatives, when they pass, sometimes have this material now.
Yeah.
And either they've been asked to donate it by the veteran themselves, or they're not sure what to do with it, and they give us a call and they say, this is what we have. We would like to donate. There's also the new museum downtown, National Veterans Memorial Museum,
right,
that has a lot of material on display. So, but they have, many of them have started talking about it. And even I noted yesterday in a report that a soldier in his 90s wrote a book with some help about his activities. And he did have some of his remaining material that he saved. And so it's starting to surface, so, which is a good thing.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The 75th anniversary of D-Day is on June 6. We're talking about how to keep the history alive, even as the survivors of D-Day and World War II, considered the turning point in World War II, dwindle in numbers. If you have a question or comment, if you're a veteran out there and have an experience you want to share from World War II, we certainly welcome your participation. The number is 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Peter Mansour.
Yeah, I was just going to add, I've talked to a lot of veterans about exactly this issue. Why in their 90s or 80s are they coming up and talking about their experiences? And I think as you reach the end of your life, you reflect on what is it that you've accomplished on this earth. And I think for many of them, they finally realize in their twilight years that the most important thing that they accomplished was serving this nation in uniform, especially in such a climactic battle such as the Normandy invasion.
What, as a historian, Peter Mansour, is D-Day still relevant to how we fight wars today?
Well, yes and no. In terms of the tactics and so forth, I think we've probably seen the last of the major amphibious invasions. It was a tactic and a technique appropriate for its era, but with precision-guided munitions now and so many more different types of weapons at our disposal, I'm not sure we're going to see a mass armada of 5,000 ships approach a beach and disgorge soldiers off of landing craft. On the other hand, it is a great example of combined arms warfare, of joint service operations. It was perhaps the most notable joint service operation in World War II, and that is still with us today in a big way. The melding of various arms and services, that is the way to fight wars successfully.
Well, you know, I was reading an article in The Atlantic about that issue of the combined forces, and that's kind of changing now with the different attitudes about individualism and countries unto themselves.
Well, you have the international aspect as well. I was thinking more of the melding of air, naval, and land power.
Okay, but
you are absolutely right. The melding of different countries in coalitions, that is with us to stay as well. As Winston Churchill said, the only thing worse than fighting with allies is fighting without them. And I think the United States, as we go forward into the 21st century, is going to find that to be the case.
John Hawes, what about Ohioans? I don't even know how you begin to summarize, how one state contributes to a fighting force, the likes of which went to World War II and fought in World War II. But is there anything that distinguishes Ohio that we should know about from that time?
I've worked on that a while because that's kind of my role, a military historian, and specifically what Ohioans did during all the wars. But about 890,000 Ohioans served during World War II. Over 23,000 lost their lives during the war. That's just Ohioans. There were Ohioans at D-Day, of course, in all the services. When you have about almost 5.5-6% of the personnel in the armed forces were Ohioans. So they were in every phase, every ship, every airplane. And on D-Day itself, the 112th Engineers, which is Ohio National Guard outfit, landed on Omaha Beach, supporting the 116th U.S. Infantry. So they were, an Ohio unit was right at D-Day. But also throughout World War II, the major Ohio unit, the 37th Infantry Division, served in the Pacific. And they fought in the Pacific for several years, from Guadalcanal through Bougainville, through the Philippines. So there were big Ohio units fighting in the Pacific, but also in the Atlantic. One of the first units to arrive in England was the 112th Engineers, because originally the 37th was supposed to be sent to Europe. So they went over first, but then they changed their minds and decided to send it to the Pacific. But the 112th stayed in Europe.
Let me just add that there are 11 Ohio State alumni buried in the Normandy American Military Cemetery in Colville-sur-Mer, and we have a study abroad program that focuses on World War II in Europe, and each year the students lay roses on the graves of the Ohio State alumni who are buried there in Normandy.
Do states still fight together in units in that way, Peter Mansour?
We have a National Guard
that is
parsed by state and organized by state, sometimes multi-state units. And yes, when they're activated, as they were for the Iraq War, they fight together as a unit. When I was a brigade commander in the active forces, our replacement unit was from the Arkansas National Guard. And so obviously most of the soldiers there were from one state or maybe the surrounding states as well.
How does that change, or is that always the way it's been? I know it was certainly in the Civil War, I imagine in World War I and on, but is that just the way it is?
Yeah, but especially with the National Guard, when the whole units get called up, they're from that state. Now, for the 112th, for instance, I noticed that when they're called up, of course, they're almost 90%, 99% Ohioans. But when they're in the service for a few months or a few years, replacements get sent in, and the replacements, they're in the U.S. Army, then the replacements can be from anywhere, For instance, I did a search of that cemetery that Professor Mansour mentioned, the Normandy American Cemetery, and you can search just by state, or you can search by state and unit. And so I did a search the other day just to see what would happen, and I did a search just for Ohioans that died on June the 6th that are buried in that cemetery. And there were 46 Ohioans that died on June the 6th that are in that cemetery. Now, that's not obviously all the Ohioans that died that day.
Just in that cemetery.
Just in that particular cemetery. But then you can also tell which units they were in. So about 15 of them were in various airborne units. A number of them were in the 112th, of course, which was the Ohio Engineer Unit. Several of them were in the 2nd and 5th Ranger Battalions, which also landed on D-Day. So you can tell where the Ohioans were serving and what units they were in.
Do you have very many firsthand accounts of those experiences from D-Day?
Yes, we do. We have a nice collection called the Columbus World War II Roundtable. And there's about 50, 55 firsthand accounts of World War II service. And about six of them, refer specifically to D-Day and what Ohioans did at D-Day.
I took a military history course in college, and it was all about troop movements, Peter Mansour. And I'm wondering, for me, as a storyteller, I guess, it would have been more interesting to hear those firsthand accounts. What do they bring to the story for you as a military history historian?
Obviously, the soldier accounts bring a lot of color and substance to the more esoteric discussions of strategy and operations and politics and so forth. So, you know, we try to include a nice mixture of firsthand accounts with broader aspects of military history in our courses at Ohio State, but you're right, it does bring the war alive.
Well, I also wonder, though, it was back in the day before a lot of people were coming forward with their stories too. Is that something that you've seen a lot more of as well?
I think we have more stories now. As veterans age, they donate materials, mm-hmm. or they'll tell their stories. I've had some firsthand experiences with taking veterans back to their battlefields in Italy and elsewhere, and the dynamics are really incredible. We took a group of students to the Pacific, for instance, and married them up with Marine veterans of Iwo Jima, and on the top of Mount Suribachi, having the veterans tell the students their stories was like, you know, grandpa telling the grandkids about the big one, and it was just amazing.
Charlotte in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Charlotte.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'd simply like to mention that my late uncle, Clyde Jerome Miller from Cleveland, and a lot of merchant mariners served through the Great Lakes out the St. Lawrence Seaway, shipping a lot of the materiel that war effort needed. They were picked off like sitting ducks by the Battle of the North Atlantic, and there were merchant mariners that were floating in those waters on D-Day, too.
Charlotte, thanks a lot. You're nodding.
Yes.
John Haas.
Yes. Yes. Obviously, Ohioans were in the Merchant Marine throughout the war, before the war, during the war, after the war, serving, taking all those supplies to the Pacific and the Atlantic, and the thousands and thousands of trips taken across the North Atlantic to bring all the supplies over to England. And also the Merchant Mariners on the Murmansk Run. A lot of supplies were sent from the United States to England and then from England to Russia through Murmansk, and that was very dangerous. So they were in dangerous waters at all times during the war.
I think the caller brings out a great point, because Normandy would never have happened unless we first won the Battle of the Atlantic, and had we first won air superiority over the skies of Europe, which was a part of the strategic bombing offensive, and all the tens of thousands of Americans who died in the skies over France and Germany. So this was Normandy was the culmination of a lot of different campaigns that came together on June 6, 1944.
We are going to take a quick break. John Haas, I'm going to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And still with us, John Haas is manuscripts curator for the Ohio History Connection. His specialty is military history. He's written extensively about Ohio's role in World War II. Peter Mansour, retired U.S. Army colonel and the General Raymond D. Mason Jr. Chair of Military History at Ohio State, will stay with us. So I hope you will, too. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
and WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The 75th anniversary of D-Day is June 6. More than 9,000 Allied troops were either injured or killed that day. Despite the bloodshed, the campaign is seen as a turning point, the beginning of the end of World War II. Those who survived the day are dwindling in numbers, and we're talking about how to keep the history alive and its relevance in contemporary life as well. And what happened that day? Still with us is retired U.S. Army Colonel and the General Raymond E. Mason, Jr., Chair of Military History at Ohio State, Peter Mansour. Tim Reeves is a U.S. Army veteran and deputy director and supervisory archivist at the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas. The nonprofit was formed in 1945 after the Allied victory in Europe to memorialize the Allied commander in World War II, General Dwight D. Eisenhower. Tim Reeves joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk about Dwight D. Eisenhower. He sounds like a radio announcer when I hear the recordings of his voice. Very perfunctory, very nose to the grindstone, down to business kind of a guy, right?
He did have a very sort of practical, matter-of-fact manner of delivery. And it's interesting that at the time, his voice was often compared to the actor Clark Gable.
Okay.
It had that same sort of staccato rhythm to it.
Yeah.
Which I didn't realize until someone else had made that comparison, but it's a distinctive voice.
It is. He was a distinctive kind of personality, Peter Mansour. What do we know about how he personally approached D-Day?
Well, he was a stand-up kind of guy. You know, when he made that famous call to launch the invasion despite the really iffy weather, when the room cleared out, he wrote a note, basically a press release, saying the invasion has failed and I take full responsibility for it, stuffed it in his pocket. Thankfully, never had to deploy it. But the fact that at the time, before the invasion had even launched, he was taking full responsibility for the consequences, good or bad, I think shows you exactly the kind of person that he was.
And, Tim Reeves, that is probably a lot of the reason why he was elected president then.
I believe so. Not only that character, but I think the success of the D-Day invasion played an awful big role in his later political career, with just the confidence that instilled in others of the competence that Ike had as a decision maker and an alliance builder.
There were a lot of setbacks in the planning of D-Day. Was there ever a point, do we know, Tim Reeves, that he became frustrated and thought maybe we shouldn't go ahead with this?
I don't believe that Ike ever had that feeling. I think his frustration and that of President Roosevelt and others was Winston Churchill's attempt to push the invasion back, and some say even hope that the Normandy invasion plan would be scrapped and that there'd be an attack continuing in the Mediterranean or perhaps through the Balkans or some alternate plan to the invasion of northwestern France.
Hmm. Yeah. Pete Mansour?
There was actually one point, I believe it was in March, where Eisenhower threatened to resign because he couldn't get control over the bomber fleets to help isolate the battlefields in Normandy through what's called the transportation campaign, hitting the French railroad lines so that the Germans couldn't reinforce their forces near the beachhead. And at one point, the argument became so heated with the bomber barons who wanted to continue pounding the Nazi industrial infrastructure that Eisenhower threatened to go to the combined chiefs and basically say, find another commander for the invasion, I'm not going to do it. And then they relented.
And this goes to that issue you brought up earlier about the combined forces and working in in concert with each other.
Yeah, absolutely. We tend to look back on World War II today on the Grand Alliance, and we see just smooth running operation and how well they worked together, when in fact there was really sharp disagreements at the time over various issues. And that's actually what made the alliance stronger, the fact that we could disagree so sharply with one another and yet come out with a unified decision in the end.
And Tim Reeves, that Dwight D. Eisenhower had a lot to do with that?
I believe, I mean, Ike was really not known for his tactical or strategical acumen. He'd never been a battlefield commander as a younger officer, but he did have that critical skill of you know, maintaining coalitions, and that, you know, for that large of a joint command, I mean, that was a critical role, and that was something that Ike could do brilliantly.
A lot of people, you know, we think of D-Day and we think of that as victory, but it wasn't. How many months went on, Pete Mansour, after that? Some pretty hellish fighting occurred.
Well, it was a 10-month campaign, 11-month campaign after June 6th. The victory came 11 months later on May 8th, 1945. So the Normandy campaign itself was 90 days in duration. 60 days locked up in this really vicious fighting in the hedgerow country and in the city of Caen and other places in the Normandy Peninsula. And then once the breakout occurred, obviously the war became more mobile. But you had a lot of fighting yet to come. The Battle of the Bulge, the isolation of the Ruhr Pocket, the really gritty fighting along the German frontier in the winter of 1944-45. So Normandy was the beginning of the end, but it wasn't the end.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're commemorating the June 6th, 75th anniversary of D-Day in World War II, considered the big turning point of World War II. You just heard Peter Mansour, he's a retired U.S. Army colonel and the General Raymond E. Mason, Jr., Chair of Military History at Ohio State. Tim Reeves is also with us by phone. He is Deputy Director and Supervisory Archivist at the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas. It was formed after the Allied victory in Europe to create a memorial to General Eisenhower. How much of the library and museum, Tim Reeves, is devoted to Eisenhower's wartime history?
It's not quite half, even though it originally began, the museum began based on Eisenhower's World War II service. In fact, it's interesting, not long after the war, these plans developed, as you said, with this foundation that had been formed. And by 1952, they had laid the cornerstone to the museum building. In fact, when I came out to Abilene to announce that he was running for president in June of 1952, he dedicated that cornerstone. The building was complete by 1954. In fact, Ike returned to Abilene on the first Veterans Day, November 11th, 1954, after the name had been changed from Armistice Day, for the grand opening of the museum. And so just 2 years, less than 2 years into his presidency, he had a museum, which at that time was devoted entirely to his military career, and then later was expanded to include, of course, his presidency. We are right now at the very end of a complete renovation of the museum, and we should reopen, sometime in late July. And his World War II career is probably about a third of the exhibits, and, you know, it's one difficulty for us is that we are actually a presidential library,
right?
And we are supposed to emphasize that aspect of his life. But you can't ignore.
Well, there aren't very many presidents who have his military history under his belt like he does under his belt, right?
Oh, maybe Ulysses Grant.
Maybe.
But it's pretty rare company.
Right, exactly. If you have a question or comment for my guests, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. How did Pete Mansour keep this secret? And how much did anybody know? When I read some of what I read said that a lot of the servicemen weren't exactly sure what they were getting into.
Well, think of the technology that you had at the time. You had phones, radio, and mail.
And only a few people had those.
Exactly. What did the soldiers have access to? Mail. And mail was heavily censored. The soldiers were kept in camps. So it's really, if it was going to leak, it was going to leak through higher officers, and they were basically threatened with dismissal from the service or court-martial if they said anything. On one famous occasion, as part of the deception plan to make the Germans think that we were going to invade somewhere else in the Pas-de-Calais, Patton, in a New Year's reception or in a gala in the Ritz Hotel, spied Eisenhower across the room and shouted out, "Hey, Ike, I'll see you in Calais." And everyone in the room just almost fainted, thinking he had given away some state secret, when in fact it was part of the deception operations. Of course, the Germans never picked up on that particular episode because they didn't have anyone in the room, but it was pretty funny.
And you know, that the idea that Eisenhower thought there was failure was a distinct possibility. As Peter Mansour mentioned, he wrote that maybe like a press release and put it in his pocket, saying he took responsibility for the failure. What was going through his mind, Tim Reeves? What do we know about what he thought in those days leading up to it? The weather didn't cooperate. They needed full moons. They needed low tides. What do we know about his thoughts?
Yeah, the anxiety he must have experienced. Yeah. And the pressure is just, I think, for most of us, you know, incomprehensible. And it was largely, I mean, the biggest questions as they neared a possible invasion date was the weather and the tides and the illumination from the moon. And there was a very, you know, relatively small window in early June of June 5th, 6th, and 7th. The weather was so bad that, you know, the June 5th date was nixed. And finally, the evening of June 4th, they were meeting twice a day that week, usually at about 4:30 a.m. and then 9:30 p.m. And the evening of June 4th at around 9:30 or 10, they made kind of a provisional decision to go. They'd wait for one more weather forecast from Group Captain Stagg, who was the chief meteorologist. And they came back early the next morning on June 5th, and I then made the final decision after pacing the floor and putting a lot of thought into it and asking each one of his principal commanders their opinion. And then after a silence that's been estimated between 30 seconds and 5 minutes, he finally looked up and said, "Okay, we'll go," and made that decision. That's probably one of the biggest decisions anyone had to make in the 20th century. And so not just the pressure of being the one to make that decision at the ground level, but just all the concerns, not only of what's awaiting you on the other side of the channel, but how's this weather going to work? And the next available date for a possible invasion would have been around June 19th. And on that date, one of the largest storms ever hit the English Channel. And so that may have ruined chances for an invasion in 1944, and certainly a later date probably would have reduced the campaign time they had during the better summertime weather. So it's hard to imagine everything that was going through his mind.
Peter Mansour.
And it's interesting, once the room cleared out, what is the Supreme Commander to do? His decision's been made. There was really nothing for him to do. He went up to an airfield and visited some troopers loading onto an aircraft from the 101st Airborne Division. And there, that's where you get that really famous photograph of him talking to an airborne trooper. It looks like he's telling him some great point of military tactics, but in fact, we know now that Eisenhower was discussing fly fishing with the soldier who was from Montana.
When the speech that we heard earlier in a couple of earlier cuts, how was that delivered to the troops? Do we know?
They actually made albums which ships could play over their sound systems. And it was produced by William Paley, who was the president of CBS News for many years. And then, of course, that they were all distributed, and you can find a lot of those copies with the Schaeff emblem at the top and the message to the soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force. But again, as Professor Mansour said, the technology was so different mm-hmm. at that time that they did rely on things like a phonograph aboard a ship on their way to Normandy.
It was on a kind of a loudspeaker or something? Or
exactly.
How much did Americans know back home about what was going on? Now, I've seen newspaper, you know, the big headlines after it occurred, but going into it, Peter Mansour?
The fact that we were going to invade France was like the worst kept secret in the world. Everyone knew that the invasion was going to occur, and the Germans knew as well. What no one knew except the people in the, you know, in the top of the Allied command structure was where and when. So there was this, as the, you know, spring weather gave way to near summer weather, people knew that an invasion was near. So there was a great anticipation of what was going to happen. Everyone knew that this was going to be one of the climactic battles of World War II. And so I think there was a lot of anticipation among the body politic back home.
How much longer could it have gone on, the war? Is there any sense about that?
This is a good question. So I just wrote a brief essay for an online journal called Strategica, which will be posted tomorrow, on the importance of the Normandy invasion, because we look back now and we assume it was going to succeed. But in fact, it could have failed. And what would have happened had it failed? That counterfactual history is really interesting. It's unlikely, I think, that another invasion would have been possible in 1944. You would
just to amass the troops,
exactly,
the resources,
and the resources. You might have had to wait another year. And if that's the case, then how does World War II in Europe end? It may end with the Soviets all the way on the Rhine River. Stalin, after the war, famously said, well, Tsar Alexander I, during the Napoleonic era, got to Paris. You know, he was like disappointed that Russian forces only got to Berlin. It might have ended with an atomic bomb being dropped on Berlin, that the first dropping of the atomic bomb would not have been on Japan. It would have been on Germany. And if you draw out the consequences of either of those alternate futures to the present day, it's pretty astonishing. So this was really a turning point in human history.
We are going to take a break. We're talking about D-Day. The 75th anniversary of D-Day is June 6th. I'm going to staying with us is Tim Reeves. He's U.S. Army veteran and deputy director and supervisory archivist at the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas. Also with us, Peter Mansour, retired U.S. Army colonel, and the General Raymond D. Mason, Jr., Chair of Military History at Ohio State. And we'll be hearing when we come back from a World War II Army veteran who parachuted behind enemy lines on D-Day. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. June 6 marks the 75th anniversary of D-Day, the largest military invasion on land, sea, and air in history. Those who survived the invasion and the war are dwindling. We're talking about how historians and others are working to keep the history of World War II alive on the eve of the anniversary of D-Day. Still with us, retired U.S. Army Colonel and General Raymond E. Mason, Jr., Chair of Military History at Ohio State, Peter Mansour. By phone, U.S. Army veteran and deputy director and supervisory archivist at the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas, Tim Reeves. Joining us now by phone is World War II veteran, Staff Sergeant Don Jakeway. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, ma'am.
I understand that you are going to be at the National Veterans Memorial tomorrow for a program at 1 p.m., right?
Yes, that is correct.
You were parachuted behind enemy lines on D-Day. What happened? What did you do? What happened?
Well, actually, when we took off on the night of June the 5th, about 10 o'clock, flew across the channel and jumped. And when I jumped into Normandy, I had looked down and they had flooded all the Moderate River, and I began to pull on my riders, and I drifted, and I landed in a little tree in a churchyard in St. Clair. And in doing so, it actually saved my life a number of times, because if I'd landed in the water, because as a parachutist, we weighed about 325 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
Carrying So I had on my personal unit, I was a demolition expert, so I had a couple of landmines, not primed, of course. At 6 amp blocks of TNT, and I had a gamma grenade, and on and on and on. And I figured if I'd have got hit with one of those tracers of things coming up, I still might be going up, you know. but anyway, I landed in a tree, and I was scared naturally. 20 years old, I was about 8 to 10 feet above the ground, and I couldn't get my straps unhooked, and so I reached down and got my trench knife off my leg, cut my risers, dropped to the ground, and ran over to the closest hedgerow. And it was 10 days after that before I found my unit. I ran into some 101st men who are about 15 miles from Carrantown, where they were supposed to have landed, and I found some British soldiers, airmen, that and they were supposed to have been cured down around Caen, because what had happened was so much flak coming over Jersey Guernsey Island, all the while the planes got shot down, and we got scattered all over the peninsula. So it took me about a half an hour to sit there, and they'd each of us a little clicker. I'm sitting there in the dark, you know, and nobody else around, and planes still going over. I said, well, I'm going to sit out here in the dark hitting that clicker, so I threw it into the hedgerow, threw it away.
What was the clicker for?
Well, the clicker was, I have one here, but I got a bunch of stuff back. But anyway, I have this clicker. You click it once, and if you get heard a clicker twice in return, that was supposed, because it's dark, you know, and that was supposed to be a friend.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, but that clicker was so loud, if I was a German, could hear that thing clicking around in the middle of the night, I'd be a little suspicious too. So, but anyway, when I went back over in 2011 with some of my friends, one of the guys came running in and said, "Hey, Jake, I found your clicker." He didn't, but so I got this clicker. He bought it, and I got it. When I go and speak to my different engagements, I use it. But
did you see the church nearby where you had landed?
Yeah, no. When I landed in this tree, the church was just to my left, a little church. Of course, I've got pictures since then, but I've got pictures of the little church. And so when I got down out of that tree, I wasn't about to go into the little church because I didn't want to think the Germans would have to see me to be firing on the church or anything. So it took me about 10 days then to get back. I found on the 10th day, I finally found my company H of the 508. And meanwhile, during that time, we were mixed in with some 101st men and some British, and unfortunately, I didn't understand there was no other 82nd Airborne men. I don't know what happened to them, but anyway, I got back to my unit, and on the 10th day. Now, in our training, and Ridgway, who was our division commander, talked to us, and he said, "You have direct orders to take no prisoners for the first 10 days. So the unfortunate thing about us, when we were kids, like we were farmers, teachers, all kind of, we never killed anybody, you know, so we were taught to kill, unfortunately. But we didn't, I don't know to a man that in my unit that ever shot a German, you know, like face to face with his hands up or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Never. But anyway, we went in Normandy. Then I fought, and this one will be living in my memory always. So it's on July the 4th, 1944, I was told to take my, I would take 20, I had 24 men, and we were to attack this Hill 95. And as we went in there, lo and behold, we found the field was mined, and the Hitler Youth Division was sitting up on the hill, and they opened up on us, and I lost 7 men from my squad. Our 508 was a frontal attack. How it missed me, I don't know, because I was right in there with my men. And we got through that. And I lost, like I say, I lost seven of my original guys that day, July the 4th, 1944.
Don Jakeway, what did you know about what you were getting into?
Well, paratrooper training is unbelievable. There's no way you can explain. And they told us, General Gavin and both Ridgway, Gavin was our assistant commander, and before we went in, he said, you're going to have an 85% casualty rate. Now, we went in with 6,000, we came out with 3,200. That's how bad it was.
Wow.
And I always did say, when we jumped in there, I was on the ground, I was down at 20 minutes after 12 midnight. Well, the seaborne invasion never started till 6:30. And we knew they couldn't get in without us, and we knew darn well we weren't going to get out without them, that's for sure. So we was in there 37 days we fought. And I've had a lot of people say, how many battles were you in? Well, when you're a paratrooper and you jump 16 to 20, 25 miles behind the German lines, surrounded by thousands of Germans, you're in a battle every day, you know?
Pete Mansour, hearing the stories like that, and a lot of it's some jargon that I don't quite understand, but does it still enrich you?
Well, it does. And you know what Don did at the time, he probably didn't realize the significance of it other than, you know, he's trying to survive. He's trying to accomplish his tactical mission. But on a broader scale, the Germans were really confused because these airborne troops had dropped all over the Normandy Peninsula, and the Germans didn't know what was going on. They actually sent one of their infantry regiments the wrong direction on D-Day. And had that infantry regiment gone towards the beach instead, the history of the invasion might be different. So the airborne troopers accomplished their mission, even if they ended up in ad hoc pickup groups like Don did. I've never heard of British troops way west. That is very interesting.
They were supposed to have been down around Caen, and the 101st was supposed to have been down around Carentan, but our planes were so scattered. And we were dropping all over the place. And like I say, I never found any of my men for 10 days. But you just keep going through the fighting and stuff like that. But the good part about this thing is the Germans thought, of course, that their original invasion was going to be up at Calais, that's where Patton. They had sent Patton up there, and they had blew up these trucks. They were balloons, and they looked like trucks, and they looked like tanks, and they looked like everything. And they had the Germans really confused. So the main body of the German panzers were at Calais. And if they'd have been down there in Normandy, where we were, we'd never made it. Because I never saw, see, when we jumped in there, I never saw a seaborne tank or anything for over six or seven days. That's how, because Omaha Beach was really a rough one, and that was the American beach, but that was really rough. But they so it was a matter that German officials, well, to this day will tell you, and I've had done a lot of research in my history and my books and things I've written. Hitler was asleep, and they generals wanted to bring those tanks down into Normandy, and they wouldn't wake him up to tell him to get the order to do that.
You know, how much, Tim Reeves, do we know about how engaged Eisenhower was on a moment-to-moment basis after the order was given? Now, we've already established there's nothing much he can do, but how much did he know?
Well, actually, his biggest concern was the weather, because if they hadn't made that decision to go, then they would have had to wait maybe another couple months or something to get the right time to go in again. So he had to make that decision to do it, and it turned out it worked out all right.
And Tim Reeves, you know, as far as after he made those big decisions, then what? Did he have any engagement with any people like a Don Jakeway?
Well, I'll tell you what disappointed me a little bit, and I don't mean this as a detriment to anybody. Eisenhower, before we went into Normandy, went to the 101st encampment. And, you know, that's where the media went.
Hmm.
Now, if you'll follow the things that's in the history now, like on your movies, like the Band of Brothers, the Z Company 506, 101st, Saving Private Ryan, same thing. Battle of the Bulge, same thing. And I want to assure you that I had a lot of respect for the 101st and everything, but Eisenhower should have come to our encampment also and paid a visit with us. So I've had a lot of people say, well, wasn't the 82nd in there?
I love the rivalry between the 101st and the 82nd. It still is ongoing today.
Well, I want everybody to know that I had no reflection with the 101st. They trained like we did, go on and on and on. But there's no individual, there's no company, and no regiment, and no one division won the war. I don't care how you book it, but when you take a look at it, hadn't been for the people back home and the Merchant Marine and all the different branches of the military and our allies, we needed them all together. So to pick out one company, out of a division, and we are the 82nd is the granddaddy of all airborne from American Airborne. You know, the 101st, the 82nd was in North Africa, Sicily and Italy before the 101st was ever formed, you know.
Just
but don't
saying.
Get me wrong.
there.
But don't get me wrong about this. God bless these guys from 101st. They're good people. And but I was a little upset that Eisenhower didn't come to our encampment. And he had plenty of time, but he didn't do it. So I didn't really get to see him personally, but he did talk to some of the guys in the 101st. Yep.
Tim Reeves, how do you respond to Don Jakeway's assertion?
Ike was a busy guy. I don't know. But, you know, after he...
No doubt about it. Yep.
Yeah. Well, there was this great documentary. In fact, we're going to show it this afternoon that Ike made with Walter Cronkite that aired on June 6, 1964, and it's called D-Day Plus 20. And he and Cronkite returned to Normandy, and, of course, Ike was doing a lot of reflecting. But he said the longest hours of his life were those between the time that the invasion was launched and before they got those first reports back.
Yep.
And
yep.
So he retired to his tent and took a Western entitled Cartridge Carnival with him and just, you know, tried to keep his mind distracted during those long hours between the time the first reports came back.
Well, you know, the thing that a lot of people don't understand, you know, he had an advisory board, a group of guys that worked with him, you know, that helped him with a lot of his work. The final decision as a commander, supreme commander, was when to go.
Mm-hmm.
But he had all these people, including Montgomery from the English and all these, and they all, some were for it, some were against it, but most of them left it up to Eisenhower, and he made a decision to go, and it was the right one. The weather cleared a little bit. We were able to get the seaborne.
Yeah, and in fact, Don, Montgomery concurred with Eisenhower's decision to go. He was one of those in the room that says, yes, let's go.
Well, I want to thank you all for joining us today. Staff Sergeant Don Jakeway, World War II Army veteran. He was parachuted behind enemy lines on D-Day on June 6, 1944. Thank you so much. He will be at the celebration, the commemoration tomorrow at the National Veterans Memorial in downtown Columbus, as will my other guest, Peter Mansour, retired U.S. Army colonel, and the General Raymond E. Mason, Jr., Chair of Military History at Ohio State. Thanks to you as well. And also Tim Reeves of the Eisenhower Presidential Library and Museum in Abilene, Kansas. Thanks to all of you, and thanks to everybody else for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.